All right, you'll continue on next three class periods, really, in Daniel. Trevor will pick up Wednesday night, next Sunday morning, the following Wednesday night. I'll be teaching the college class, next couple of classes, being there. Well, this morning we're in Daniel, chapter 5 and 6. What I'll do this morning, I'm going to do a brief overlook of the history. We've covered it. Just sort of a summation, bringing some of the key things together on a couple slides. Won't spend much time on that, but it might be useful to you later on. Chapter 5, handwriting on the wall, a familiar story. Chapter 6, Daniel lion's den, probably one of the best two stories. Be a toss-up between that and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, right? So these are two well-known, certainly, for this period, good studies for young children, right? So if you easily taught. We'll take a look at the end of the class period at five significant prophecies that we've looked at. Sort of keep some of these prophecies in front of us because that's very key for this period. Understand the prophecies, what they mean, and what their role is, what's happening. So we'll take a look at that. Okay. All right, we'll start here with the history. We're going back now to about 625 actually. They call this a Neo-Babylonian Empire. Neo meaning something that's new, because you had a prior Babylonian kingdom prior to this for several hundred years. So that's why they sometimes refer to this as a Neo-Babylonian. Really, the first key king is Nabopolassar, the father of King Nebuchadnezzar. So he really started to come to power in about 625 B.C. Now, 625, the Assyrians are still in power. What happened in 612 B.C.? 612, you had a fall of what capital city? Nineveh, the capital of Syria, all right? So that 612 is sort of significant from that standpoint. And, of course, that fell to Babylon in that period of time. So we got Nabopolassar coming to power about 625. But this is the period of Babylonian kingdom. Abraham went up from where? Ur of the Chaldees, all right? That's the first time I really hear about the Chaldees. The Chaldean Empire is synonymous with Babylonian Empire. So that's not anything new to it. It's been in history, Bible history, and in the history of man for a long, long time. So really, down in here, here's Babylon right here. And these kingdoms would rise and fall, compress and grow over a period of time, depending on their sphere of influence. So this is the Babylonian Empire in purple under the rule, really, of King Nebuchadnezzar during that period of time. Well, a couple salient facts then. Nabopolassar, I noticed, pointed out about 625. You remember, while King Nebuchadnezzar was away fighting a battle in 605 against the Assyrian and Egyptians, at what place? Remember the name of the place of that battle? Carchemish. Well, he was there. He received news shortly after the battle. His father died. He wanted to go down in Egypt. He couldn't. He pulled back and went back to Babylon. So Nabopolassar died in 605, and Nebuchadnezzar assumes power. Now, without doubt, the greatest of the Babylonian kings of this period. He built the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, and really terraces on which he built the gardens. That's attributed to King Nebuchadnezzar. Now, I often wondered if that's why he would take the craftsmen. Remember, he took all the craftsmen back to Babylon with him, left the forest behind. We talked about that a little bit, but certainly he had a lot of things happening back home, and it happened after, for the most part, the captivity, 605. So he would put those craftsmen to work. At that period of time, his son, Evil-Merodach, takes power. Reference to him in 2 Kings chapter 25. It's sort of interesting about Jehoiakim. He lifts him up out of prison and elevates him in a pretty high position. In fact, the account of 2 Kings says above other kings in Babylon. So he raised him to a position in the nation of Babylon, which is pretty interesting. But treated Jehoiakim very kindly up until the day that Jehoiakim died. So this historical note about Evil-Merodach reigned only 2 years after King Nebuchadnezzar. History tells us that Nebuchadnezzar was a great ruler. He had one weakness in his kingdom. He left no succession planning. He didn't prepare his son or anybody else really to rule after him. And so after Nebuchadnezzar, there really was not another strong king in Babylon. So even Merodach rules 2 years. Nergal-Sarnessar assassinates him, who's his brother-in-law. And he actually ruled, best we can tell in history, about from 560 to 551. A little bit cloudy as to what the exact years are, but about that period of time. We piece that together because he's followed by his son, the Basham Marduk, and he only reigned for 9 months, we know, before he was assassinated by Nabonidus. So you sort of piece that one period of history together, how we sort of arrive at these years. And he reigns, Nabonidus then reigns until 539. And he actually plays into the Bible history a little bit, because now we see Cyrus, who meanwhile has been gaining power. Nabonidus is conquered in 539. Cyrus continues on to Babylon, where our story in Daniel chapter 6 picks up with Belshazzar. Belshazzar is the son of... and he's a crown prince, but he actually rules in Babylon. And see, most feel like that the kingdom was sort of divided. In Lower Babylon, we find that Belshazzar is actually sort of reigning. His father didn't have a lot of interest in some parts of the reigning of the kingdom. So historians really believe that Belshazzar was probably the stronger of the two, even stronger than his father. Even though he was not actually the king, he would have been a crown prince, but actually had a lot of power during that period of time. So in Daniel chapter 6, the story we look at this morning, our Cyrus defeats Nabonidus, continues on to Babylon, where Belshazzar is at. And of course, he is killed either by Cyrus or Darius and me. We're not sure which one in 539. And that's our story in Daniel 6 this morning. So this is sort of a capsule of the history of Babylon during this really a short period of time, from 625 down to 539. As was prophesied by Daniel, after Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, thou art the head of gold, there'll reign up another kingdom after you, it'll be a divided kingdom. Remember the breast and the arms of silver, the Medo-Persian Empire. And here you see, sort of on this map even, Persia sort of down here, Media began up here by the Caspian Sea, historically. And so we look a little bit about the Median Empire. Really was existing during the same time that Nabopolassar, back there in the 625 coming down in time, it began to gain a little bit of power. Now the Assyrians, as they came to power, the Chaldeans didn't like them, the Medes didn't like them. So during that period of time, you found the Chaldeans in the south, the Medes in the north, sort of fighting against Assyria, never powerful enough during that period of time to really overtake Babylon. Overtake Assyria. And then of the two, Babylon rises to greater dominance over the Medes. What's interesting in history, it appears like even though Babylon was a dominant power, Medes were still sort of allowed to coexist, not as the power. Certainly under the influence of Babylon, but still had a lot of influence and a fairly good-sized kingdom during that period of time. Historians tell us their greatest power from 563. Even though I didn't see this in studying some history, it stands for reason, because King Nebuchadnezzar died in 562. So after his death, there was nobody to take his place with any power. So it's saying it's reasonable. That would be why the Medes would rise in significance and power following the death of King Nebuchadnezzar. The Medes, of course, they were defeated by Cyrus of Persia in about 549-550. So you've got the Medo-Persian Empire. So reverence, you recall, in Daniel chapter 8, we're there in that vision, as that vision is interpreted. We know without a doubt that the first king was Babylon, the second was that of the Medes and the Persians, because Daniel tells us that in Daniel chapter 8. So Daniel refers to this in Daniel 8 by inspiration as the Medo-Persian Empire. So we know we're correct in calling it the Medo-Persian Empire. That's what Daniel 8 calls it. So during the period of time, Persia was more dominant of the two, but the Medes were the other part of that empire during that period of time. Darius the Mede, of course, the one referenced in our story in Daniel chapter 6. Now, he is not Darius or Darius the Great, spoken of later. This is Darius the Mede. But here's the Median Empire during this period of time. We'll just touch upon the Persian Empire. We'll come back to this. Persia becomes dominant, certainly in the return of the children of Israel. The Persian Empire, probably the most expansive of all these. You'll see Persia extending down into Egypt, something Nebuchadnezzar wanted to do, was never able to achieve. What Cyrus did that others were not able to do, extended way over into Asia Minor. And so a fairly expansive empire under Cyrus. The Peace of Medes, 549-550, come to dominance very, very quickly. His reign and his dominance from a military standpoint are characterized by the word quickly. Nabonidus, we said earlier, he was defeated by Cyrus 539, moves on to the capital city of Babylon, where Belshazzar is having his feast that night, as we see in Daniel 6. Belshazzar is killed. A key thing about Cyrus, he reversed the policy of captives. Now, we look at the history from a biblical standpoint. Now, we remind ourselves that Israel is only a very, very small country. If you look here, there's what Cyrus was concerned about. Well, what piece of that is Israel? If you had to guess percent-wise, you know, you look at the empire, it's really a tiny, tiny piece of his empire. You can almost cover it up with your fingertip right here. So Israel is one fingertip of his entire empire, so to speak. So he was concerned about things much more important to him than Israel. Now, from a biblical standpoint, we see that as the most important. But historically, Israel was just a small piece of what Cyrus was dealing with. Now, we know it was important because God had appointed him, as we see in Isaiah 44 and elsewhere. And, of course, he's reigning during the return of the first captives we see in Ezra 1. This is sort of just a summary of what's happened. We'll come back as we look at the return from captivity and talk more about Cyrus. So just sort of a quick look at some history of what's happening during this period of time and sort of try to capture it in a couple slides where we got the salient points of history before us. We can come back and revisit it any time, use that as a summary. Okay, now we come down to Daniel 5. Again, a pretty well-known story in the Bible. Maybe not so much so as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or Daniel Lion's Den, but certainly one that we're familiar with. Not a very difficult story to understand. We just went through the history. So the historical setting of this, historians tell us, and the records of the kings tell us, that Persia is already outside. They are outside the gates of the city of Babylon. So we've got Persia outside, and even though they're outside the gates, his father's already been conquered. Whether he knew that or not, we don't know. His father already been conquered, but now here's a great feast. The story is told the Persians were waiting and waiting, and they seized upon this opportunity. The feast historically was deemed to be so great, they saw that as an opportunity to take Babylon sort of by surprise, which they did. So that's sort of the historical setting here in Daniel chapter 5. So we're 539, Cyrus and Persian army outside the gates of the city. So now it's almost like Nero while Rome burned, right? Here's Belshazzar, crown prince. Persians are outside. So what's he doing meanwhile? So that's sort of the setting which makes this pretty interesting here in Daniel 5. So he has a great feast. He has his thousand lords there, and they're drinking wine. It's interesting to me that by inspiration we have some very specific words used here. One I found interesting was he drank wine before the thousand. I don't know if that's different or not. It caught my attention. I don't know if he normally did not do that or did it as a normal practice. It just interested me that it said he drank wine before the thousand. So while he tasted the wine, he commanded the golden vessels that were carried away in 586. Remember now that's recorded now in 2 Chronicles 36. Where they went in, they carried away all the gold, the silver, they carried all that away. He commanded that to be brought out, that they might use it. And so they did. They brought it out, and then they began drinking wine from the things that were taken out of the temple. Now, what's interesting is, about this, is that God allowed it to be taken away, right? God removed His presence from the temple. We saw in a previous study. God has said to Ezekiel, they're going to profane my temple. They're going to profane my temple. And it was prophesied these things would be removed, and they were. Certainly God allowed all that. What's interesting to me is, even though God allowed all that to be, the gold, silver, the vessels to be taken out, there was still the attachment. It was still God's, even though it was taken to another land. But here it says they drank wine, praised the gods of gold, silver, brass, iron, of wood, and of stone. So they're drinking out of the vessels from the temple, not giving any praise to God who wrote the Creator, but worshiping the gods of the stone, the wood, the silver, etc. So that moment in time, in the same hour, you see the handwriting on the wall. That's a phrase we use today, right? We use that phrase today if something is very, very clear to somebody. Hey, you know, handwriting on the wall. That means, pretty clear to see, a handwriting on the wall. That's where this expression comes from. We use that expression. Now you see the fingers of a man's hand, another statement later, sort of the back of the hand, and he writes over against a candlestick, so here sort of in the shadow, right? On the plaster of the wall of the king's palace, the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. So he's drinking wine, the same hour they begin to drink out of the vessels from the temple, the handwriting on the wall. Joints of the loins loose, and his knees smote against one another. So here his knees are knocking, right? He's frightened. He doesn't know what this means, but he thinks it might be bad. So he's frightened because he doesn't know what this means. As we've seen before with other visions, going back to Daniel 2, King Nebuchadnezzar, he calls in his magicians, his wise men. They try to solve it. They don't know what it is. Now, what they were solving was not what was written. That appeared to be pretty plain, what was written. But what did it mean? Well, it's not the word, but what do these words mean? The hand wrote these four words or five words on the wall. What did it actually mean? So it says, the man who solves this, the clothes of purple, chain of gold about his neck, shall be a third ruler of the kingdom. Now, discuss here, why the third ruler of the kingdom? Why not the second? Based on the history we just covered, Daniel will be third, exactly right. So you had Belshazzar as a crown prince. So he wouldn't have been the second, been the third ruler. Okay? Now, beginning verse 11, is very interesting. Verse 12, the queen comes in, perhaps his mother, perhaps his wife, we don't know which one. They come in and say, don't be concerned. There is somebody in your kingdom that can solve this for you. This man lived back during the days, your father Nebuchadnezzar, your father raised him up to be chief over his wise men. So he said, you call Daniel and he'll show you interpretation. So, that's the next step. We bring him in, he asks him, are you Daniel? Are you the one? He said, yes, I am. So he recounts to him how others could not show him interpretation. Verse 16, but I have heard of thee that thou canst give interpretation and dissolve doubts. This is all the American standard, but I like that phrase right there. You can dissolve doubts. So he felt like he was the one that could interpret this. Daniel's response, interesting, let thy gifts be to thyself, give thy rewards to another. Nevertheless, I will read the writing of the king and make known to him the interpretation. So in that statement, Daniel is really saying what? He's not concerned about the gifts. He says, I'll tell you what you want to know. You keep the gifts yourself, and you give the rule of the king to somebody else. So we see that Daniel now is an older man, right? Carried in captivity in 605. Don't know his age. Young by the language we see in some places. How young, we don't know. But you go from 605 down to 539, it's about 66 years. So you would surmise his age to be 80, 80 plus, we don't know, but in that range. Not a young man, but he hasn't changed since the time of Daniel 1, when he has resolved that he would not break God's law. None of that's changed. He's been in captivity all this time. He has not lost his faith. Now he takes a moment to remind Belshazzar of what God had taught his father Nebuchadnezzar. And this is a story we looked at last time in Daniel 4. Because Nebuchadnezzar was elevated in his own mind. He had built the hanging gardens of Babylon. Became great, powerful. He forgot who gave him that power. He was driven out until he knew that the Most High God ruled in the kingdom of men. So Daniel recounts this story to Belshazzar. What's interesting, verse 22, and thou, his son, O Belshazzar, hast not humbled thy heart, though thou knewest all this. Now we know from God's standpoint, even we're ignorant, that's no excuse, is it? Ignorance is not an excuse. But in this case, he says, you should have known better. But before you brought the vessels of gold, out and begin to drink wine with your lords, you should have remembered what God did to your father Nebuchadnezzar. Even though you knew all this and you knew why God made him walk the earth as an animal, even though you knew this. And there's a great lesson right there, right? A good Wednesday night lesson. Even though you knew it. A great lesson there when you teach this. Another way it says, but thou hast lifted up thyself against the Lord of heaven. In what regard? What's the focus here of him saying he lifted himself up? What specific thing do you think he had reference here? That's right. He's talking about the vessels that were taken out of the temple in Jerusalem. And so even though God allowed these things to be taken out, and even though God is far above gold and silver vessels, right? Interesting here that this is the reason that was given. And the fact they not only brought them out, but they praised the gods of silver and gold. You remember that Nebuchadnezzar, after Daniel came out of the fiery furnace, Nebuchadnezzar praised Jehovah. And he made his decree that all nations of the earth should recognize the God of Daniel. See, now all that has been forgotten. And he magnified these other gods. Now the handwriting on the wall. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. Here are the words. We're not left to wonder what it means, because he said, here's the interpretation. Mene says, God hath numbered thy kingdom, brought it to an end. And now here are the days. The days of your kingdom, here they are, and are now being brought to an end. So your time has come. Tekel, your weight in the balances and found wanting. There's another phrase we use today, right? You find a lot of common phrases even yet today. Thousands of years after first written, still in our language today. You see the influence of the Bible in man's lives. Even though they don't know where it came from, the influence is still there. Weight in the balances and found wanting. Perez, a word that is synonymous with upharsin. This word means divided. The kingdom is divided, given the Medes and the Persians. And here again you see that reference, the Medes and the Persians, we talked about earlier. So no question what's happening. We think back to Daniel chapter 2, we see this tied together right here. You read Daniel 2 alone, you wouldn't know this. You couple Daniel 8 to check Daniel 2. Then you know that the second kingdom after the Babylon were the Medes and the Persians. And you see confirmation of that right here. He follows through. He makes Daniel the third ruler in the kingdom. Exactly. He does what he said he would do. And in that night, the Chaldean king was killed. Meanwhile, the Persians came through the wall, overtook the city. And so Darius the Mede is now the one to reign. So there, Daniel chapter 5, the handwriting on the wall. Here is Daniel 6, same to follow historically, chronologically, in the same time frame. Because if you scroll all the way into this chapter, Daniel prospered during the days of Darius and Cyrus. Because it's the same period of time, right? Cyrus is the supreme ruler. Darius is a ruler really under the influence of Cyrus the Persian. So as they take over Babylon, they take 120 princes, set them in power. They take three presidents, put them over the 120. Daniel was one. Notice verse 3 that he was distinguished above the other presidents. To the extent that Darius said, I think I'm going to make Daniel over the whole kingdom. Now, politicians being what they are then and still are today, this thing called jealousy sort of crept in. Said, wait a minute. It's bad enough that you made a Jew one of the three presidents. Now, you're contemplating making him elevated above the other two presidents. So jealousy kicks in. And what's interesting in verse 4 and verse 5, they were trying to find some occasion where they could go to the king and say, look, you need to deal with Daniel because he's done wrong. Now, embedded in here is a great lesson for us and for all students. Romans chapter 13, verse 1, the powers that be are ordained of God. Paul said we got to be in subjection to the powers that be because of that reason. Daniel was. This says that God's will then is the same as it is today. It's God's will that we submit to the law of the land. Well, they found out that, and they knew that Daniel was going to do that. He was a law-abiding citizen from a Persian and Median standpoint. Well, if they're going to find fault, they had to do something with him serving his God. And so this story continues. They had the king make an edict that if any man worships a man or a god, important phrase there, they worship a man or a god for 30 days, he'll be cast into den of lions. And so he signs the edict, which cannot be changed by law. Verse 10, one of the key verses, probably the key verse of the chapter. And Daniel, when he knew the writing was signed, he went into his house. Now, the windows were open in his chamber towards Jerusalem. He kneeled upon his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he did aforetime. He didn't do this to specifically defy the edict, did he? He's been doing this. He's been doing this aforetime. He simply does what he's been doing. He's been praying three times a day before. He'll continue to pray three times a day. So he continued to do what he thought was the right thing for him to do. Acts chapter 5, the chapter with Ananias and Sapphira. The apostle was arrested, put into prison, brought out. They were charged not to teach anymore about the Jesus. Then they said what in Acts 5:29? We ought to obey God rather than man. So here's a good passage to tie in with this comment here about Daniel in verse 10. We ought to obey God rather than man. True then, true today. God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. God is the same. Now, God demands preeminence. He has preeminence. He demands that from our part. Well, what a very hard thing to do. They found Daniel praying. They come before the king. And they said, that Daniel is of the children of captivity of Judah, regardeth not thee, O king, nor the inner deck that thou hast signed, and make his petition three times a day. When the king heard it, he is sore displeased. Why do you think he is displeased? I think at least a couple reasons. What's one?
Well, he knows that his law had been going against, but
he had respect for Daniel.
And he couldn't change it.
He couldn't change it. He said something. He maybe was a little bit foolish, right? He basically made an ultimatum. If anybody does this, he'll be thrown lined in. So he liked Daniel. That bothered him. I think also, what has his underlings actually done? He had been manipulated by them, right? And he recognizes that. He realizes that they had used him to gain their purpose. And here he is, the king, right? So he tried his best, labors of going down to the sun to rescue him. Exactly what he did, we don't know. The next statement they put here, they came back and said, look, king, you signed it. You've got to follow through. You don't have a choice. So he tried what he could, but was not able to alter what had been done. They called him, and it's interesting, as they throw Daniel down, he says, thy God, whom thou servest continually, he will deliver thee. Now, what's interesting about that statement is when we come down to verse 20, when he comes to den, he says, O Daniel, servant of the living God, is thy God, whom thou servest continually, able to deliver thee from lions. He says up here, he is able. Now he comes out the next morning, he says, is he able? A little bit of doubt, wondering, was God really able to do this? And so he comes out in the morning, they throw him in a lion's den, as the story goes. He comes out the next morning, he asks this question. Daniel said, O king, live forever. My God has sent his angel and has shut the lion's mouth, and they have not hurt me. Daniel immediately gives God the praise here. For as much as before him, innocency was found in me, and also before thee, O king, have I done no hurt. So he said, God protected me because I was innocent. Protected me because I was innocent. King was glad. No manner of hurt was found upon him because he had trusted in his God. Another key phrase. 24:25, the accusers, the enemies of Daniel, they, their wives and children, were thrown in the lion's den, dead before they hit the bottom of the floor. So quite a story, quite a picture right here. You're left to wonder how many people that was. One man, five men, 10 men. If you look at the phrase earlier in the chapter, all the princes, the satraps, in other words, this is a large conspiracy. The mind left to just judge. How many people are we talking about here? We normally think of just a handful. It could have been a lot of people involved in this right here. He makes a decree very similar to that made by his father Nebuchadnezzar after Daniel was taken out of the fiery furnace. So twice Daniel was delivered by God. Both times, Nebuchadnezzar and now Belshazzar makes this decree. Shall fear before the God of Daniel, for he is a living God and steadfast forever. And his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed, his dominion shall be even unto the end. And then these few words here, he delivereth and rescueth. That had been demonstrated now a second time. So Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. So two stories here that are pretty well known to all of us. But some great lessons. Got just a few minutes left. Remind ourselves some few key prophecies. We started with this back in the first class, Daniel chapter 2. It's a prophecy that begins at Babylon and goes all the way to Pentecost. There's one prophecy right here. It takes you from Babylon to Pentecost. God, here's a vision Nebuchadnezzar had. Head of gold, another kingdom, a third kingdom of brass, a fourth kingdom strong as iron. He said, you're the head of gold, so Babylon was the first kingdom. We know from Daniel 8, we've read it before, the Medes and the Persians would be the second kingdom. We saw that again today in our text. So Medes and Persians came after that. Also in Daniel 8, after the Medes and the Persians, they're going to rise up that great horn, Alexander the Great, with the Grecian Empire. You'll study that in one of the next two class periods with Trevor. So now the nation of Greece rises up. So we're not left to wonder what the first three kingdoms are in Daniel 2, because the scriptures plainly tell us. The fourth kingdom, it would be diverse from all of these, would be different, would be a mighty kingdom. It would be the fourth after these. There was not another world power after Greece. Greece basically ruled up until the time of Rome with the Seleucids. We studied that in our introduction. We'll look at it in more detail later. So the next kingdom in historical order is that of Rome. There is no other kingdom in between. Plus, we looked at other internal evidence. The scriptures would show us that it was during the days of these kings, verse 44, that God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. Unlike these other kingdoms, the fifth kingdom of Daniel would never be destroyed. These other four are going to rise and fall. Of course, he's talking about the kingdom of Christ. Well, very key prophecy of this period of history. Remind ourselves, Ezekiel 6 through 12, all of Ezekiel's prophecies, we can look at some in Isaiah and other places, that said there's going to be a siege against the city of Jerusalem. The city is going to be overtaken. There's going to be a slaughter. Many killed with a sword. And remember that God says, I will not have pity. In that same section, they shall profane my secret place. Robbers shall enter in and profane it. And that ties back into Daniel 6 today, or Daniel 5 today, right? Robbers, what did they take? Well, they came in and took all the golden vessels and the silver vessels. So here's another prophecy that sort of helps us tie this period of history together of what's happening. Ezekiel 6 through 12. Jeremiah 29:10, a key prophecy. You're going to be carried into captivity, but now you're going to return after how many years? After 70 years. So Jeremiah says, there's an ending to this. Later on, Daniel is walking in the garden, and Daniel sees what? Daniel sees the writing of Jeremiah. So he had access to that. And so here's another key prophecy. For thus said Jehovah, after 70 years are accomplished for Babylon, I will visit you and perform my good word toward you in causing you to return to this place. So it says, you are going to return after 70 years. Isaiah 44, going back to this, Isaiah prophesied in about what years? What century did he prophesy? Handwriting on the wall somewhere here. Oh, don't have the years up here. All right. He prophesied about the fall of the northern kingdom, right? Which happened in what year? 721. So 721, Sargon II comes in and takes Israel away into captivity in the northern kingdom. So it's the time preceding that, shortly thereafter. All right. So he's back way back in the 8th century B.C. when Isaiah prophesied, Isaiah 44, thus said Jehovah my Redeemer. Notice that language there. That said, Jerusalem, she shall be inhabited of the city of Judah. They shall be built, and I will raise up the waste places thereof. So there's going to be a restoration. Judah's not even been carried in captivity yet. So you're predating this from about 740, roughly, down to 586 before they carried away 150, 60 years prior to this. And then you come down to 539, you're almost 200 years from the time Isaiah makes his prophecy. That saith of Cyrus, he is my shepherd and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying of Jerusalem, she shall be built. So we need to impress even young students with this point, that 200 years before Cyrus was raised up, God knew who he was. He knew by name, he knew by person. Cyrus wasn't born yet, not even thought of yet. He was many generations away from being born. And yet God knew who he was. There is the power of God, the foreknowledge of God, the omniscience of God, right? 200 years before, he identified this man, called him by name in Scripture. Very key. Jeremiah 22, I think, is a key prophecy because of the premillennial theory. We want to keep that before us this period. Because here in Jeremiah 22, a passage we ought to be familiar with, at least know where it's at. What did I do here? I made a mistake. I had it, didn't copy it. I apologize. Jeremiah 22 is the one that says that no man will sit and prosper upon the throne of David after Coniah. Talking about Jehoiakim, Jeconiah, that same king. Now, you think about that. Well, but they returned from captivity. They came back from captivity. Was there a king over them? Who ruled over the captives when they returned? First man by name was, you recall his name? You're right. Gedaliah, right, Daniel. Let's say Gedaliah, and it was a governor, right? So even Cyrus, when he allowed him to come back, he put a governor over land. He realized they had to have rule, right? So not as though they came back and God put a king back on the throne of Israel. Now, no, they continued to be dominated by other people and really ruled, you know, by the Persians, then by the Ptolemies, then the Seleucids. So they were basically a state within a state. From this point onward. So Jeremiah 22 certainly come to pass. Alright, our time this morning. Trevor will have a class Wednesday, next Sunday, and the following Wednesday. Very interesting. I told Trevor, I'll take the hard chapter of Daniel, which I've covered. He's got the easy ones left. All the questions of Daniel 9, 10, 11, 12, he'll answer for you. We got extra lessons up here if you ever miss one. There are some extras of most up here.